Welcome back. You're tuning into CKLN 88.1 FM. My name is Susie Alvarez, and the name of the show is Word of Mouth News. On this Friday, March the 12th, we started a little bit delayed. We were waiting for my co-host, Kristen Schwartz, who's on her way. I gather the rain has put a bit of a delay on her arrival. But we have a good show coming up for you. We're going to begin with a focus on Canada and Colombia trade agreements and how this have been restarted on Tuesday in Ottawa. Second reading took place and has begun on free trade agreements with Colombia, and we're going to be sharing with you an interview conducted by CHRY's news programmer Candace Moores, who recently met with someone who is an activist and is following closely the paramilitarization of Colombia and the role that Canada plays, even though silently, in the continued harassment and displacement that's taking place in that southern country. And then at 6:30, we're going to turn the mic over to Don White in Anti-Psychiatry Radio. He will be bringing us updates, views, and news on the ongoing struggle against the psychiatry establishment. But we're going to head on to headlines. We're going to shorten them up so that we make room for our feature piece for this first half, and this come to us thanks in part to a variety of sources, and Kristen is now here in the studio joining us, so welcome here to the station.
Hi, Susie. Hi, everybody. Sorry to be late. For tonight's headlines, we go first to Pakistan, where at least 39 people have been killed and nearly 100 injured in a double suicide bombing in the city of Lahore. A number of army vehicles were targeted, and at least six Pakistani service members were among the dead. This incident is the latest in a series of deadly militant attacks that have spiked since the Pakistani government launched a major offensive near the Afghan border last October. This week, militants have also struck a government building used to interrogate suspects, as well as the office of the U.S.-based Christian charity World Vision.
And in Israel and the occupied territories, the Israeli government has imposed new closures on the West Bank. The Israeli government has sealed off parts of the West Bank to prevent what it called anticipated Palestinian protests. The move comes just hours after U.S. Vice President Joe Biden left Israel following a visit marked by an announcement of a plan to build 1,600 new homes in an East Jerusalem settlement. The U.S. and Canadian governments have criticized the settlement plan, but we should note that the Obama administration, and Canada as well, has refused to call for cutting any of the billions in aid that Israel receives until it accepts a settlement freeze. Israel has apologized for the timing of its announcement to build new homes, but has also refused to abandon the construction plan.
Meanwhile, in Gaza, a British journalist was released on Thursday after nearly 4 weeks in jail under the Hamas government. Hamas has accused the journalist, Paul Martin, of being a spy for Israel and says he will be permanently barred from the occupied territories. Upon his release, Martin said that he was targeted for being a journalist.
And in Yemen, the United Nations is warning millions of people are enduring starvation amidst an international focus on security issues and confronting al-Qaeda. The UN's World Food Program says nearly one of three Yemenis, more than 7 million people, struggle to find adequate food, with 2.7 million deemed severely food insecure. Yemen has the world's third highest rate of malnutrition. The UN says it will be forced to suspend food distribution in several areas unless it receives millions of dollars in emergency funding by June.
And in Somalia, heavy fighting continues between nationalist militants and government-backed troops. At least 43 people have been reported killed and over 150 wounded since Wednesday. The African Union-backed government forces and the Al-Shabaab fighters have been locked in a tense standoff since the government announced plans in January to dislodge Al-Shabaab from Mogadishu. Shabaab, who control 80% of the south and central Somalia, have vowed to topple the government, which owes its survival to the African Union forces, neighboring Ethiopia, and the United States. Somalia has been racked by two decades of bloody violence, sparked by the ouster of President Mohamed Siad Barre in 1991.
And in Greece, a nationwide strike was held yesterday to protest new austerity measures announced to tackle the Greek debt crisis. Clashes erupted after more than 10,000 people marched through the city of Athens to denounce a series of spending cuts and tax increases. Federal regulators are currently probing major Wall Street firms for their role in Greece's financial collapse. Goldman Sachs is said to be the most important of more than a dozen banks used by the Greek government to manage its national debt using derivatives.
And also yesterday in Chile, a 7.2 magnitude aftershock hit the central region. This is the most powerful aftershock to hit the country since the initial 8.8 magnitude earthquake struck last week. The aftershock came shortly before right-wing billionaire Sebastián Piñera was sworn in as Chile's new president. Piñera replaces Michelle Bachelet, a former political prisoner who took office in 2006 as Chile's first female president. On the morning of the handover, hundreds of people gathered at the presidential palace in Santiago for a farewell ceremony. Bachelet's supporters paid tribute to the outgoing president. She was ineligible to run for re-election under a recent change to Chilean term limit laws. Piñera is Chile's first right-wing president in 20 years.
And in South Africa, anti-apartheid activist Winnie Madikizela Mandela has stoked a major controversy after publicly criticizing her ex-husband, former South African President Nelson Mandela. In an interview with the London newspaper The Evening Standard, Madikizela Mandela criticized the terms of the agreement that ended apartheid in South Africa, saying it had preserved the economic subjugation of the country's black majority. Speaking of her former husband, she said, quote, "He agreed to a bad deal for the blacks. Economically, we're still on the outside," unquote. She went on to describe the Mandela name as, quote, "an albatross around the necks of my family," unquote, and said she could not forgive Mandela for accepting the 1993 Nobel Peace Prize with former South African President F.W. de Klerk.
And maybe we'll skip forward to some Canadian news. The big story tonight in Canada is, of course, that in February, supposedly 21,000 new jobs were created, many of them full-time. But, read the fine print, most of these were in the public services, the sector of the economy which faces massive cuts in the coming months or years as governments try to pay for all that stimulus. There were tens of thousands of jobs lost in retail, finance, and insurance.
And in Montreal today, controversy continues over the banning of a Muslim woman from two French language schools for refusing to move her niqab. Cartoonist Terry Mosher published a cartoon in the Montreal Gazette portraying a woman in a niqab as if she is locked in a prison. Naima Atef Ahmed has twice been asked to lead provincially administered French language classes for new immigrants after refusing to remove her niqab, which covers the head and face and leaves only the eyes exposed. The instructor told her it was important to be able to see others' faces. Premier Jean Charest defended that school decision, saying that people who expect to receive public services must show their faces. Ahmed was filed a complaint with the province's Human Rights Commission, and as an immigrant to this country, someone who took English classes, you don't need to uncover your face to learn English. That is pretty obvious to many people.
Thanks, Susie. In Vancouver, CTV has agreed to a live broadcast of tonight's opening ceremonies of the Paralympic Games for its BC audience only. In other provinces, viewers will have to wait until 2 p.m. tomorrow. Paralympic President Sir Philip Craven criticized the decision of CTV, saying it absolutely smacks in the face of one of our four values, which is equality.
And that's it for tonight's headlines. Next, we go to an interview with Jasmine Histrope, author of the book Blood and Capital, The Paramilitarization of Colombia. I think
this was recorded in November, but it's very timely as this week the Conservatives tabled the Canada-Columbia Free Trade Agreement in Parliament. On Wednesday, reviving a deal that many thought better left for dead. It's just weeks after an Amnesty International report found that Indigenous peoples in Colombia are at risk of being exterminated by state forces, right-wing paramilitary groups, and guerrilla organizations. At least 114 Indigenous people were murdered last year. And at the same time, Colombia's National Labor School reports that 45 trade unionists were killed in 2009. Colombia has long been the most dangerous country in the world to be a trade unionist.
And while former Liberal leader Stéphane Dion had committed to voting against the Canada-Colombia free trade deal, Michael Ignatieff has not taken a firm position, leading to fears that the bill will pass. According to journalist Don Paley, the Canada-Colombia deal will open market access for certain Canadian commodities, flooding the Colombian market with Canadian wheat, barley, and other grains. The key provisions of the deal relate to the security of Canadian investments in the mining and oil and gas sector.
Today, an editorialist for the Globe and Mail, in speculating on the Harper government's reasons for pushing this deal forward, wrote that the Harper Conservatives are intent on giving moral support to Colombia against the left-leaning governments of Hugo Chavez, Evo Morales, and others in the region who are forming their own trade bloc and threatening the domination of Latin America by the United States. So
we're going to go to a quick music break, and then we're going to set up this interview. We'll be right back. Here is from Colombia, Hip Hop Judios, and the name of the song is Agua para la Gente, a song about water and the rights of everyone to water, which water is one of those commodities that, well, one of those things, rights that become commodified once free trade agreements are negotiated. So we'll be right back.
We are going to hear from Jasmine Christoph. Are you there on the line, Jasmine?
Yes, I am, Candace.
Okay, maybe first we can begin with an introduction. Who are you and why are you here on the show?
Well, I am a PhD candidate in the program of sociology at York University. And I have done a lot of research on the Colombian armed conflict, and also more generally in the fields of militarization, state violence, neoliberalism, and social movements in Latin America. So recently I published a book that came out from Ohio University Press in the United States and Between the Lines in Canada, and it's called Blood and Capital, the Paramilitarization of Colombia.
Great. And so what is your book about?
Well, the book examines the Colombian armed conflict by looking at issues such as poverty, inequality, human rights, violence, and revealing the mechanisms that generate these conditions. And in this process of looking at the mechanisms, there's one theme that comes up and goes through the whole book, and that is the issue of the use of violence in processes of capital accumulation and how does that occur. Basically, that's the central and most important theme in the book. And I am presenting a new approach to conceiving the Colombian armed conflict, and that approach consists of accomplishing three objectives, basically. The first one is to visibilize the magnitude and the nature of human rights violations in Colombia by looking at the perpetrators, the victims, and the struggles by those who have been victimized. The second objective is to challenge the mainstream representations of the conflict, which can basically be described as two main kinds. The first kind is portraying the conflict as if it is one between the state versus the terrorists, which is the guerrilla in this case. And basically the state here is portrayed as trying to protect the population from the violence of these irrational, dangerous narco-guerrillas. The second kind of mainstream portrayal of the conflict is one where it is shown to be a result of a struggle between left-wing armed groups, the guerrilla, and right-wing armed groups, the paramilitary, with the state being this neutral third actor in the middle trying to contain the violence. And neither of these representations is accurate at all, and that's why I'm hoping to offer this new approach to understand the conflict. And the third objective that the book has is to complement and also fill in the gaps in what we can consider as progressive or leftist literature on Colombia, or that's been published within the last 15 years. And in that context, I'm trying to give more attention to local power dynamics and how local dominant groups use violence for processes of capital accumulation. And this helps us understand the huge displacement that is taking place and the land inequality and so on. Because so far, even within the progressive literature, a lot of attention has been given to how United States, through its military and economic interventions, fuels the conflict, but not enough attention has been given to the local power dynamics. And this leads me to the last point which the book tries to accomplish, which is to give a good description of what really the paramilitary is. Because so far, there has been an inadequate conceptualization of the paramilitary. It has not been understood fully as a phenomenon on its own. So this is what I try to do in the book.
That's quite a challenge, I'm sure. I was wondering if you could expand on, you know, this definition. Maybe you could tell us, you know, what is a paramilitary?
Sure. Well, of course, I can give you a very complete overview in a short time. Basically, that's the task of the whole book, right? To do that. But just briefly, the paramilitary, we're talking about armed groups that are affiliated with the politically and economically dominant groups that have been carrying out human rights violations against members of the public, against civilians, who are thought to be in some way dangerous to the establishment. In other words, dangerous to those who are in power. And those categories of so-called enemies, or people that are considered to be targets, are very diverse. They range from left-wing politicians to leaders of social movements, such as peasant movements, indigenous movements, women, students, progressive academics, human rights lawyers, and so on. Also, people living in areas of strategic economic importance, such as areas of potential oil reserves, gas reserves, and also the homeless or those on the street who are targeted for social cleansing. So these are the different kinds of people that are targeted by paramilitary groups. And unfortunately, the state has been complicit throughout all these years, since the 1960s, when these groups were first created with the objective of helping the state combat left-wing guerrilla groups. And later on, there was another wave of paramilitary group creation, which was directed by the elite in the 1980s. And then these groups expanded, and grew in terms of financial and territorial power and military power and so on. And currently they are set to have demobilized, but unfortunately, in reality, paramilitary activities still persist, although they are no longer regarded as paramilitary groups. So basically, these are groups who, with the complicity of the state and often with the collaboration of the state, have been carrying out activities against the kinds of social sectors that I mentioned.
I guess I'm curious where these paramilitary groups came from and how they operate, you know, who funds them, whose interests do they serve?
Okay, so they serve the interests of landowners, cattle ranchers, foreign companies, local companies, people in the emerald business, and drug traffickers. And sorry, what you asked, how do they sustain? So these are their sources of funding, and they perform different kind of services for these groups. So these include protection from the guerrilla, also displacing people from areas that are considered of strategic, economic, and military importance, persecuting members of social movements who are considered to be a challenge or dangerous, and eliminating them. So in other words, this is the activities of the paramilitary demonstrate this single most important theme in the book, which is the use of violence for purposes of capital accumulation. And this is basically violence is used to displace and guarantee access to resources, to silence or to suppress all those that are considered as opposition, as dangerous, as challenging the system, as trying to construct a new society, and also those that are simply considered to be a nuisance or the garbage of society, the very poor people on the streets that are targeted for social cleansing.
And that was an interview between Candace Moores, host of News Now up at CHRY at York University, and Jasmine Hristoff, who is a graduate student at York and the author of the book Blood and Capital, The Paramilitarization of Colombia. Again, that's recently published just late last year by Between the Lines. That interview was conducted in November, and we bring it to you now in light of the moves this week by the Harper Conservatives to bring in the Canada-Colombia Free Trade Agreement in support of the Colombian government, which the Harper government calls a democracy, despite the evidence of massive state repression, particularly against indigenous people, peasants who are in the way of multinational corporations and trade unionists. So thank you, Candace, for making that available.
And I think that brings us to a close of this first half of tonight's word of mouth news for Friday, March the 12th. Don White is setting up on the other side of the glass, and he should be here in a couple of minutes. We're just going to outro this first half with Hip Hop Judios. So keep it locked on 88.1 FM.
Let me plead my case. This is a motion in tort. They took the water, now they sell it back. How can corporations get away with that? Roban el agua, roban la gente. Making mad money como pinche decadentes. Man, will I be feeling ill? But without ice cubes, it's kinda hard to chill. Knick-knack, paddywhack, give it all the bone. Hip-hop with just take the microphone and say, yo, Dre, I hate to annoy ya. You ain't no doctor, but I'm a lawyer. And I'll destroy ya. Cause your 50 cent piece is fiction like Tom Sawyer. Ooh, did I say a bad word?
agua pa' la gente, no es agua que se vende.
It's going, they're taking it cause it's flowing.
Agua pa' la gente, no es agua que se vende.
It's going, it's going.
Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door, cause they pumped the well, there was nothing more. Stole the water, sold it out, like a pimp would do his daughter. Feeling crazy, memories hazy. Can't stop, the stuff don't faze me. $1 million here, $1 billion there. Where's my health plan? I thought you don't care. Time for that, never time for this. This situation makes me pissed. Change the locks, and they change the pipes. Double the price, and they call it nice. You're gonna catch that stray bullet. You're gonna catch what's coming to ya. I got my red badge of courage. Te vas callar, huh? Agua pa' la gente, no es agua que se vende.
It's going, it's going. They're taking it,
sounds good.
It's going.
Agua pa' la gente, no es agua que se vende.
It's going, they're taking it, cause it's flowing.
Agua pa' la gente, no es agua que se vende.
It's going, they're taking it, cause it's flowing.
Agua pa' la gente, no es agua que se vende.
It's going, they're taking it.
If you feel alright,
yeah, yeah.
Clap your hands if you're ready to fight.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's going, it's going.
Yeah, yeah.
It's going, it's going.
Agua pa' la gente, no es agua que se vende.